Good day, everyone. My name is March Twisdale, and you're listening to my 2019 Encore series of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. This show was recorded in the studios of Voice of Vashon and airs at 11 a.m. every Saturday and 12 noon every Monday on your favorite station, 101.9 FM, KVSH. Thank you for making Voice of Vashon and Prose, Poetry, and Purpose a part of your day. And I'd like to talk to you all about bread. Homemade bread, to be specific. For all of my life, I've literally never seen a loaf of store-bought bread in my dad's kitchen. Not once. And I think this reminds us that homemade bread is about more than simply healthy eating. It is also about independence and self-sufficiency. I'm not sure when my dad developed his appreciation for homemade bread, because he used to tell me stories about eating Fluffernutter sandwiches, which are made out of Wonder Bread with marshmallow cream and peanut butter, if I remember correctly. He grew up during the post-World War II consumerism craze, when anything wrapped in plastic with a shelf life of 3 months or longer was all the rage. Of course, the result was a mouthful of cavities by the time he was 10. But his parents grew up during the Depression. Putting food on the table, any food, was an accomplishment to be proud of. And so, by the time I was old enough to remember anything, my dad was baking bread. Actually, when I was quite young, I remember hardtack. Yes, if you ever served in the Marines, I'm sure you just choked on your delicious imported coffee and are wondering if I mean what I'm saying. Yes, that's exactly what I'm talking about. Hardtack. Which, if I remember correctly, is essentially water, wheat, and possibly nothing else. Hardtack was traditionally created for people who would be on sea voyages hundreds of years ago because it was so lacking in nutrients that literally nothing could consume it, including mold and things like that. Anyways, believe it or not, when you're 5 or 6 years old and your dad tells you something is delicious and amazing, you believe it, even if it actually tastes a little bit like glue. No joke. And by the time I was 9, thank goodness my dad had rediscovered yeast. And I can remember being sent out of the house to, quote, go play and don't come back until I call you. That was bread baking day. And I'm sure my dad loved having the house or the apartment to himself all day long. But more than that, he didn't have to worry that I'd go running through the house, boom, 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 while the bread was rising. I'm guessing I probably flattened a few loaves before he adopted the new rule that I had to be out of the house. In the late afternoon, as I was running around, out and about, wherever, the smell of my dad's labors would waft down the street or the walkway between the apartments, and many children not related to him would find themselves standing shoulder to shoulder with me, wondering what that amazing smell was. On that day, we would eat freshly baked bread, just out of the oven. The outside would have a thin but crunchy crust. The inside would be soft and moist and would melt the butter literally right off the butter knife. That night, the loaves would be cooled enough to go into the freezer to be pulled out once or twice a week, for about a month or so until it was time for another baking day. This was literally my childhood. My favorite way to eat my dad's bread was toasted under the oven in the broiler section with butter and brown sugar and cinnamon. Have any of you ever done this? People can toast bread. You can toast store-bought bread, pops out sort of like a piece of crunchy cardboard. And you can smear butter on it, and you can sprinkle brown sugar on it and some cinnamon, but it's not the same. When you pull out a loaf of homemade bread, you get to slice it as thick as you want. And in general, people like bread sliced a little bit thicker than what you get at the store. And then you put the butter on it, and the brown sugar, and the cinnamon. And when you put it in the broiler section, it all caramelizes under the heat of those flames. And, you know, they used to have them in a drawer that you'd pull out from the bottom of the old ovens. The heat was just high enough to make a perfectly crunchy, sugary crust. Of course, This is sort of like bread as dessert, but who cares? It's amazing. And because of this way that I grew up, when I moved out and went to college, I started baking my own bread. It was delicious, inexpensive, and filling, which is perfect for every college student's budget. I'll forever appreciate my dad for his decision to spend his life baking his own bread. So just want to remind everyone that there's something special about baking bread. And if you haven't done it before, give it a try. It's an amazing experience. And now, on to this week's show. And now, let me welcome this show's guest author, Deborah Bussman, calling in from Monterey.
Hi, happy to be here.
Yay! So it's been a year and a half, but we finally made it happen.
I know. Perseverance.
Oh, in all things, right?
Yes.
Okay, so Deborah, your novel, Like a Woman.
It came out late March.
Got it.
Just taken off.
Yeah. All of your readings seem to be just packed with beautiful, colorful, fabulous people.
The readings have been phenomenal. The books have sold out. Every time I've given a reading, the books have sold out. I just got back from Minneapolis where I did 2 panels and 2-3 readings. And the press sold out of the books after the very first event. Something's taken off about it, and I've been getting great reviews. The LA Times just did a wonderful review, so.
Yay!
I know, it's exciting.
Okay, I do have to say, I really think you should have taken more books to AWP.
You know, I think that the publisher should have taken more books to AWP.
There we go, publisher author responsibilities, slightly diverse.
Because they, you know AWP, they have the big book fair, right?
And right.
All the presses have all their authors' titles.
Yeah.
You know, they take what they imagine will sell, but something happened with this one. So it was quite a phenomenal response, so much so that they were jokingly calling me the queen of AWP.
Aw, how sweet.
Yeah, so it was exciting.
Oh, yeah. So that's where you and I met, which was in 2014, February. And one of the things that people know if they live here is that lots of things happen at the convention center. But what's nice about AWP is it wasn't just there each night. It like exploded like an octopus all over the city, like venues everywhere from restaurants to bars to coffee shops had all these different reading events. It was like one massive all-night-long, all-day-long party.
Yeah, it definitely takes over a city. The events are way more than what any convention center can hold. So,
and writers are far from the image of quiet, mousy people who sit in a cabin and generate books every once in a while. I mean, man, there are a lot of very outspoken and savvy people out there in the writing community.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, writers, we're the same as everybody else. You know, some of us are quiet and mousy, and some of us are, you know, loud-mouthed, drunken louts, and some of us are, you know, brilliant, and so we all come.
Yes, but we're all really good at sharing our thoughts, whether it's in text or in verbal readings. Exactly. Okay, so I am looking at your book here, which kept me up. Of course. And you know, really, I read a lot. And there are those books that you can just read a chapter or whatever each day. This is one of those ones I really couldn't put down. I love how you structured it. But first, what I want to do is give people a real sense of what this book is about. And you did that superbly in February of 2014. When I was in the session, the AWP session titled Social Action Writing, Our Words in the World, and you were presenting. So you want to go ahead and share that introduction with us?
Sure, I'm happy to.
Thank you so much. Okay, your turn.
Okay. The brilliant Audre Lorde once admonished, "Your silence will not protect you." And of course she is right. Although at times, in those small moments of everyday cowardice, it can sometimes feel as if it might. Silence, a story. I am a 40-year-old reentry student at the University of California. In class, I am silent. I sit through lectures by those with the many initials after their names, knowing myself to be a total fraud, an imposter who does not, quote, belong. head down, terrified that I will be found out, busted, and kicked out of the university, I am silent. Although now a grown woman and successful business owner, my educational self sits stunted at adolescence, barely having finished junior high school, the bad kid, the troublemaker, too stupid, surly, and stoned to be wanted in anyone's classroom. Growing up, I was about the furthest thing from, quote, college material as one could get. Yet here I sit, decades later, a student at the fancy university. Even though I am old, re-entry students are fairly well tolerated. The important thing is that I am white, so as long as I stay silent, I can pass. As long as I stay silent, because I am white, I am presumed to belong. As long as I stay silent because I am white, my presence is not questioned. So I learn to hide the not-so-middle-class markers of my bad teeth, bad education, bad language, and I ride that silence like a free pass at the boardwalk, paid for by stolen coins. This I know how to do, to steal and to pass. As a kid, I put on my pink pressed white girl blouse, comb my unruly hair, and steal stores blind as security all ran to follow my young, dark-skinned Mexican friends. You know, the dangerous, untrusty ones. Now, at the university, I am utterly in love with language and learning, intoxicated with books. Fierce is my hunger, and I am eating knowledge like a feral dog at a steakhouse dumpster, gulping, gnawing, stealing away the best bones for later. I am silent, but I am learning. Then one day, the white male sociology professor with the sparkly good teeth and the many initials after his name is going to give a lecture on juvenile delinquency, adolescent drug use, homeless youth, teen sex workers, his dissertation topic, his field of expertise, my life. I am on heightened alert, cautious yet curious. But what comes out of his expert mouth is an articulated spew of such stunning ignorance. His words are big, but his knowing is not. I think about my friends on the street and then listen to the professor's words, pompous, patronizing, and pathologizing, pitying at best, and I am utterly stunned. He doesn't know anything about them, I think. This expert is completely ignorant. I know more than he does. There was something terrifying yet exhilarating about that moment when the veil was pulled from the illusion of academic expertise. I became obsessed with the question of authority, authorship. Who has the power to tell whose stories, to craft and shape and warp the dominant narrative, to gather initials after their names like little ducklings and assume that their privileged perception is the one capital T truth? And in those warped tellings, whose stories are erased, disappeared, or at best twisted into some unrecognizable perversion of reality? As social action writers, part of our work is to break silence, challenge the master narrative, insert counter-narratives into the dominant domain, disrupt, and yes, dismantle. But at that moment, I was not yet a writer. I was a 40-year-old reentry student with the stunted psyche of an adolescent street kid. And when I began to write, which I knew immediately that I must, it was not my academic authorial voice that came through with its contested analysis. No, what emerged as I put pen to paper were the voices of the kids I hung out with on the streets of L.A. so many decades before, dealing drugs, hustling tourists, shaking down Johns, sleeping in cardboard boxes out behind Montgomery Wards. Here is a brief excerpt from the piece that emerged that day, now the title chapter of my novel, Like a Woman. The other girls tell me I'm going to have to dress like a woman if I'm going to make it on the street. Screw you, I laugh. I've been fucked all my life, and I've never had to wear a dress yet. Just trying to help you out, girl, they call out as they walk on down Santa Monica Boulevard, ankles bowed out over wobbly spike heels, popping their gum and adjusting their spaghetti strap bras as if they had something special going on down there. Don't none of us except Lisa have any tits yet, and even if I had them, I wasn't about to go dressing in no drag shit. For one thing, it costs too much, and I got better things to do with my money. For another thing, I can't hardly walk in that shit, much less run or fight. Some girls can, though. I seen one girl whip off those fuck me pumps and bust a motherfucker trying to get something for nothing across the side of his head quicker than I could have cracked his nuts. Said she fucked up his eardrum because she got the pointy part right inside his ear hole. And see, check out that blood, girl. I think she was just feeling good because she got his wallet, messed him up, and didn't even break a heel. Today, as an educator and social action writer, part of my job is also to encourage students to break free from their own silences, to truly bust open the master narrative. I'd like to close by reading a brief excerpt from a piece called You Gotta Be Ready. To teach creative writing and social action means you gotta be ready for the young blonde girl from a private high school in Sacramento suburbs who rolls her Maybelline eyes the first day of class and says, is this going to be one of those courses where they try and ram that multicultural crap down our throats? The same girl who weeks later sits weeping in class, heart and mind open, listening to shared stories of INF thugs and deported grandfathers and pesticide-poisoned baby brothers wheezing from asthma. Stories about cousins orphaned by police bombs dropped on fellow family MOVE members. 7 and 9-year-old brother and sister taken from their home, sitting in the Philadelphia police station, surrounded by cops watching the bombing live and in color on TV news, laughing, telling the children, see those flames? See those tanks? That's your daddy inside there. That's your daddy we finally got right where he belongs. And the young, blonde, private high school student who truly believes that California always, quote, belonged to the United States and that racism ended with the abolition of slavery, or at the very least after Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech, turns her face to the class, Maybelline running down her cheeks, and says, I'm so sorry. I didn't know. They never taught me about any of this. I'm so sorry. I just never knew. And her workshop buddy, Aisha, the self-described Pan-Africanist revolutionary, takes the girl in her arms, rocks her softly, and Carlos, sitting in the back, can't help but shake his head, muttering, damn, and they got the nerve to tell me that my people are, quote, underprepared for college?
Yep, just as great now as it was then.
That kind of brings it all together. It brings out, you know, kind of what I'm up to today. It brings out the origins of the book. It brings out the work I do teaching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in an incredibly compassionate way, makes it okay for people who just don't know yet to go ahead and open up your eyes, look for the answers, and start finding out. I appreciate the acknowledgement of human imperfection and the lack of judgment, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So that was your introduction to the session, Social Action Writing, Our Words in the World. And then we spent about a year bouncing around between your very busy schedule as a professor and an author and all these other things. And now here we sit, and I'm looking at this book, and we talked a little bit about, is it a memoir? Is it a novel? Because you published it as a novel. You wrote it eventually as a novel. But there's clearly personal experiences that have informed this. So explain a little bit about what you were telling me earlier about what was happening when you were aiming for memoir and how a shift to writing this as a novel sort of freed you up and made things easier from the writer's perspective.
Right. Well, I had initially just started writing stories out of my life. And as they kind of were gathering, it felt like it could possibly, you know, kind of coalesce into memoir. But I was struggling with that as a genre. And it sounds funny, but it was harder for me to tell the truth in memoir than it was in fiction. Mm-hmm. So fiction kind of freed me up to tell maybe a bigger truth, maybe a truth not fettered with the constraints of did I get the exact date right or time right, or You know, I had questions also about the other characters, you know, mm-hmm. who at that point were friends. Did I have the right to tell their stories? Mm-hmm. You know, were they mine to tell? And once I fictionalized everything, a number of things happened. One, it gave me as an author a tremendous amount more compassion for the main character,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, whatever, we can psychoanalyze it, but I think, you know, we all have elements of lack of self-worth and kind of we're a little more, I know that I can be a little harder on myself. And once I shifted that from being about me to being about this character, Taylor,
mm-hmm.
I just completely fell in love with her. And I had her back. I was fierce about her. I enjoyed her, you know. So then the stories took off, and then all kinds of things happened. Other characters started writing their own stories and speaking to me, and it definitely went beyond my own personal experiences.
Right.
And the characters just took over. So it freed me up. It freed me up to do the bigger work of the novel, because it's not really about my personal story. It's about something so much bigger than that. And
right. No, I think that's actually a really incredibly good point that you just brought up. I mean, let's see, The Color Purple. That's not a memoir, but it could be the memoir of hundreds of thousands of women. And Memoirs of a Geisha, technically a novel, but once again, it could be literally a memoir. So there's something about being able to look at a person that almost creates a greater ability to become intolerant or judgmental. And this novel, Like a Woman, these experiences, which are really intense, they are not all wrapped around one person, so we don't get to judge into judgment of that person. But at the same time, what I want to really make clear, novels are seen as being fictional, untrue, and exaggerated. And this book is filled with realness.
Yeah.
And then throughout it, you have these little pieces. As a child, I believed. And there, so what were you doing construct-wise? What are you trying to do with the little pieces?
I was just looking at the one that you talked about, the As a Child, I Believe. And that one, you know, I'll just read the first part of it. As a child, I believed we came from wolves, somehow lost, separated inside the city's mass. The children, that is. I had no idea where adults came from, but I thought that children were all adopted, picked out like puppies from the pound. Some got good homes with lots of room to roam and food. Some could only cower at the boot, snarl, or run away to try again. My home was not particularly good, except that it was filled with other strays. The pain came mostly in the night, and there was enough to eat. So that's the first part of that.
Right.
And so it's a completely different voice. It's not the, you know, adult, disembodied, third-person narrator.
Yeah, it's not
the child narrator. And yet it also is. It's almost as if it's the child who has come through on the other side.
The minority voice as a concept is sort of near and dear to my heart. And I won't go into all the reasons why, because I've sort of touched on it before in previous shows. It seems that people don't recognize the value of the minority voice. It's a learning curve that people who grow up as part of the majority need to go through. And my impression is that you bring the minority voice. You have been bringing it. What's it been like to be professionally engaged in this world, you know, academia, the university, you know, you work there, you're lauded. I don't know. What's that been like?
It's been some of the most amazing, you know, blessed work I've ever done. I mean, it's an absolute privilege, just in terms of the work of teaching and the work of, particularly in the program I teach in, which is called Creative Writing and Social Action.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a unique creative writing program that is interdisciplinary with, you know, so we look at Africana studies, Latino studies, history, philosophy, all kinds of things. And then, you know, I get to teach the creative writing and social action aspect. And it's all about honoring the stories. And like you say, not letting one master narrative or, you know, dominate the discourse. So we need all of the voices. There's nothing wrong with mainstream voice. It's just, you know, everybody's voice needs to be heard. And that's part of the problem is that, you know, there's only certain voices that kind of pervade the airspace, the heart space, the story space. So in my job, I'm actually paid to invite all of the stories, and it's beautiful work. And, you know, where I teach, there's a lot of first-generation students that, you know, they're the first in their family to go to college. I work with a lot of students coming in through the migrant ed program, so they're sons and daughters of farm workers. And, you know, to have those stories hold classroom space with stories from somebody from Compton or South Central, somebody from Orange County, somebody, for, you know, international students. So you have everybody together in a classroom just honoring one another's stories.
Mm-hmm.
And it's beautiful work. It's
right.
Beautiful.
One of the things that you brought up was emotional development and how our emotional development can be stunted.
Well, I think, you know, I think in part for kids that are being raised, you know, under various forms of abuse, whether it's, you know, incest, sexual abuse, physical abuse, spiritual abuse, educational abuse, whatever, you learn adaptive behavior, right? You
mm-hmm.
learn whether it's like to be the parent in a family and take care of the alcoholic mom, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or to be the responsible one or whatever. So you have a tremendous amount of power in a sense,
mm-hmm.
even as you're really powerless, but
right.
you overcompensate. And so you've got, you know, 10-year-olds kind of running the show and taking care of paying bills and taking care of things, right? Because the parents
mm-hmm.
are not capable of it. So it's a mix because you don't get to go through kind of the traditional coming of age awkwardness and bumbling and fumbling through adolescence and trying things out. You have to become super tough, right?
Mm-hmm.
Old. So you give the appearance of being all together,
mm-hmm.
and you certainly cope. You know, I mean, the kids that I'm writing about that are on the street, you know, they can survive in situations that most adults could not have survived, right? But there still is the undeveloped self that got stunted at that age of where the abuse happened, right?
Right.
You didn't get to keep maturing at kind of a, you know, a soft and malleable way, right?
Right. It's almost like, you know, a plant to grow needs to have adequate, you know, soil, nutrients, water, and sun. And, you know, if you like put in a dark environment, do all these things to it, and it ends up surviving as this sort of whitened out rather than deep green thing, and it sends a few tendrils out, and maybe it's still alive 6 months later or 3 months later, but it's not going to have fully grown into itself. And so some of these stories, let's see, we in this novel, people need to be ready for the harsh realities that I would say more people on this planet actually experience rather than less. I mean, if we're really looking on a global level, you know, everyone knows that the sex trade is something that exists and it's a growing massive issue. So let's just talk about that subject for a minute. You know, it's one thing to have this illusion of these bad people who, you know, grab a kid and they go off and they do something horrible. But there's also, you know, drug addicted moms who are letting men come into their homes and having sex with their 4-year-old daughters in exchange for their next high. I mean, there's this little girl, Taylor, who literally does all these strategies to figure out how to predict as mom comes home. Is she really drunk and angry? Is she going to beat me up? Do I have to get out the window? You know, am I prepared to run away? There's some really, and then the neighbors and what they're going through and how they try to deal with it. This is some painful stuff.
Yeah, it's incredibly painful. And yet part of what I'm trying to do in the book is also show kind of the miracle of resiliency.
Yeah.
You know, like even given all this, I mean, given the brutality and given the abuse, It's like these kids are just trying to figure out not just how to get by, but how to love, you know, and how to care for each other, and how to laugh, and how, you know. So there's something about the human spirit that even in the worst of the worst, there's this little part that, like, to think of your plant analogy, even in concrete, right?
Mm-hmm.
The blade of grass comes up looking for the light, looking for the sun, you know. Mm-hmm. So there is that in the human spirit that that seeks to thrive, even as, yes, these horrendous things are going on. So it's interesting because, you know, a couple of the early reviews, every review has been just really, really positive. But a couple of the early reviews were focused on just how many hard things happen, right? The brutality of life on the streets. And it kind of caught me by surprise because, of course, I know that's true, but the focus in my mind isn't on that. Mm-hmm. To me, that's a given, and I'm interested in how cool is it that these kids are, like, being so creative and courageous and fighting and resilient, you know, and imperfectly bumbling, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you know, trying.
I believe you completely nailed that goal. I absolutely, totally took it that way. I mean, yes, there's the painful things because, of course, I mean, there's a couple of books by Stephen King that I couldn't finish because I have younger brothers. They're 12 and 14 years younger than me. So, like, Pet Sematary and Cujo, both of those books, and It, all three of those books, I had to stop because they involve small young children and hideous things happening to them. And all I could do is keep seeing my younger brother Ethan's, you know, beautiful blonde, curly haired, little blue eyed face in my, and I couldn't go there. Like, I just could imagine how I would be destroyed if any of these things happened to my brother. And therefore I had to put the book away. Your novel didn't do that for me, but there are books that are, for lack of a better word, sob stories, or they just pound you into the pavement with the misery and horrendousness and a hopelessness of something going on. You didn't end up in that category is what I'm trying to say. And definitely, I'm really proud of and impressed with and grateful that Taylor and so many real world people who have rough starts in life, you know, are able to survive and find a way through.
Yeah, and I didn't want to romanticize street life either.
Mm-mm.
Because, you know, it is pretty horrific, you know. It's brutal, but that's not the extent of who they are,
right?
You know what I mean? It's the conditions under which they're navigating, but they still are fully human,
right?
And so that's kind of what I was getting at. And also, you know, not to have it be like, okay, the streets, like, childhood was rough and the streets were horrendous and then she survived and now look at her now, right? But, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps success story. It's also not that. Part of the reason that I end the book with the ocean scene and their drowning scene,
yep,
is to show that even after you get through it and you survive, you still are in a kind of a continual process of survival and healing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even when you've removed yourself from kind of the horrific conditions, there still is all the internalized damage that you still have to navigate, right?
Well, yes. And for me, having grown up on the coast of California, you know, the realness of that final piece. I mean, every year there were, you know, I graduated from Morro Bay High School.
Okay, you know.
I do. And, you know, every year there were the kids who went out surfing and they didn't come back. And there were the tourists who would go out on the rocks and get too far out there and a sneaker wave would come in and that was it, you know. So, yeah, so very, very real, that last one. And so amazing. I have to ask, is that a real story?
That's an absolute real story. Yeah. That is
wow.
An absolute real story.
And that's your story.
Yes.
Deb, I know exactly what it took to decide to go into that water.
Yep.
I'm really, yeah. Wow. Oh, boy. Yeah. Okay. So, everybody, you are listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose on 101.9 FM. My name is March Twisdale. My guest author is Deborah Bussman, who has recently published Like a Woman. This is her novel, but it definitely has, it started off as a memoir and for really great reasons shifted to a novel. It is going to be really awesome if you can grab your calendar right now, or if you're driving your car, don't. But try to remember to check for Wednesday, June 24th. Is that it?
Yep, Wednesday, June 24th at Elliott Bay.
Perfect, yes. So everyone knows Elliott Bay Book Company if they live in the Seattle area. And Deborah is going to be up here doing a reading. Of course, that means that, you know, you can meet her, you can listen to her, you can pick up a signed copy of Like a Woman, which is currently orderable if you don't want to wait that long. But I recommend heading down there and hanging out because, I don't know, every single experience I've had with you so far, Deb, has just been awesome on many, many levels. I'm really glad you wrote this book. I'm so glad you wrote this. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
And so let's go ahead and move on a bit because we definitely have some more time. Oh, thank goodness. We've got about 10 to 15 more minutes. So let's see. One other thing I'd like to touch a little bit, maybe on generational shift. But before that, you know, I've been sitting here thinking about how I want to ask this question because it's a small island. And as most of my regular listeners know, I moved a lot as a kid. Yes, I graduated from Morro Bay High School, but I was only there for 2 years. And I went to actually 17 different schools between kindergarten and graduating high school. And so I always found myself making friends with generally not the in crowd. Let's put it that way. And my whole life, I found that there are the people who maybe it's really easy in a casual way to observe them and think, oh, that person's together. They're with it. They are successful. You know, all the markers, you know, your hair's conventional. You know, maybe you wear a little makeup, maybe you don't, you know, whatever. You're just looked at visually from the outside and viewed as things are going okay. Mainstream would probably be the best word for it. And then there's all those people who are the outsiders, right? For the novel, or the people who are on the fringe and all those different titles. And what I always found was that the people who were fringe were just really incredible people. But because they didn't look quite right on the outside, people would look askance at them.
Right.
And one of the things that I struggle a little bit with, you know, I've got teenage kids now, and they've got lots of friends, like about four different friendship groups, really, that my kids sort of float between. And I just get the sense that young adults have so much more to them than maybe the adult demographic sort of gives them credit for.
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. It's such a rich, rich time. And the internal knowledge, even though it's all kind of in flux and it's hormonal and it's, you know, it's confused. I mean, it's serious business navigating one's humanity, you know, figuring out what does it mean to be in this world, you know. So they're engaged in the struggle, you know, as they come into adulthood. So, yeah, they're. You know, I learn from my students every day. I'm just in awe. I mean, oftentimes it just brings me to my knees, you know, what they know and what they're grappling with on that journey. Right.
Right. And so I read recently an article. I think it was pretty well resourced. And it said that 40% of millennial parents. So, right, we had, what did we have? We had Generation X, and the, you know, there's always names we have for basically people who come of age, I would say within a specific decade or even a half decade. So millennials, people who were coming out of high school as we moved into this century, that 40% of millennials who are parents are currently living under the poverty line. And there's a totally different world right now that young people are entering into than what I was entering into and what my mother's generation, like really a woman who's involved with the radio station here, and she and I were talking about this, and she is about my mom's age, so, you know, close to 60. And she said, for me, when I came out of high school, or especially out of college, the impression was that the world was your oyster. Right? There was still so much, there was still expandability on this planet. We were still reaching outward because there was more to move into. And now so many people I know who are coming home with college degrees are, you know, in this area, you're considered lucky if you can get a job at Starbucks because you're battling with people who have master's degrees. And, you know, so now you get a college degree and you move back home again. I'm not sure if my generation and your generation is really recognizing what was in place and what opportunities existed in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s and how very different it is right now. And we look at the young people and there's a sense of, well, I did it, why can't you? I really think they're dealing with a whole different ball of wax.
Right. Well, and they're also dealing with, you know, a worldview that's kind of dominated by the media that is telling lies all the time, right? So that creates kind of this chasm of consciousness where, you know, their lived reality is not what's being reflected, right? But what's reflected is what is supposed to be normal and true. So it's, you know, it's this huge disconnect. And, you know, I think also, you know, I know when I was coming of age, you know, there was a sense that there was possibility and that you could make something happen. You know, now I think a lot of times they're growing up with families who have lost wealth.
Yeah.
You know, they've actually gone the opposite direction. So it's not, you know, every generation gets a little bit more and you get a little, you know, little more footing, economic footing. Now it's like they're experiencing their parents losing ground.
Right.
And I think that's a scary thing also for a lot of kids.
Well, in 2008, I believe, right as, you know, the big, real estate bubble, whatever you want to call it, the most recent planned economic collapse occurred. There was a really interesting article, and I'm pretty sure, I think it was written actually by the Seattle Times, so I can't credit it directly, but I think it was one of our local journalists that wrote this. And it basically said, I wish that I could go back to the Great Depression because of, you know, the 1930s, because that was a much better situation than the one we're facing right now. And at that time, of course, you'd had a complete, you know, collapse of Wall Street, you know, stock market. And so in some ways, it looks like it was worse because they didn't do what they did this time, which was just throw a bunch of money at the banks and keep them floating. But his point was, back then, you had a lot less people in this country. You had a lot more land that had not been resources. I mean, you had a whole world still out there that these people could move towards. So even then, when, you know, a bunch of people lost wealth and kids were like, oh my gosh, this is, you know, terrible. I'm growing up in this time there. I think even then, when you really look at it, I feel I made this little image and I was mentioning it to my mother or my son a couple days ago. I said, you know, it's like we've come up to the edge of the planet and we banged into the edge and we bounced back inward because we've hit the wall and we bounced back in and then we bumped into the other people who were heading towards the edge. More and more people are bumping and bouncing back and we're all just bumping into each other because we've sort of in some ways really hit that wall. And I believe that the young people, I think they're dealing with a whole nother level of acceptance that we've got some issues that has got to be hard to grapple with when you're 17 or 18 or 19 or 21 and you're trying to figure out how you're going to make a place for yourself in the world.
Well, yeah, and, you know, a lot of students that I work with, you know, are young students of color, and they're also in a really different state where they're watching now where almost every day there's a new young person of color that's gunned down by the police on TV and shown on the 24/7 news cycle again and again and again. So I'm seeing a tremendous amount of pain in the young folks. And it's not like police violence has not happened.
Right.
It actually historically has been pretty steady ever since kind of the origins of police work during like the early slave patrols. So police violence, particularly against young folks of color, is not necessarily on the increase, but what's happening now is that it's getting publicity.
Right.
And so, you know, these students are watching, you know, Michael Brown lay on the pavement for 4 hours
right.
and no one tending to his body. They're looking at, you know, a little 11-year-old, you know, Tamir Rice shot at a playground, you know,
mm-hmm.
and his sister handcuffed. So they're witnessing that level. And it's not, you know, most of the students I work with have come from communities where, you know, they're very familiar with police violence. So it's not news to them, but it's horrifically traumatic.
And when it's in your face constantly and you don't see your society quickly and, you know, in shock responding and attempting to correct, you know, then you suddenly go, even if they see it and they know it's really happening, wait, why aren't we getting the reaction we need? You know, and yeah, I agree with the media. We recently got a couple of PCs. I have always had sort of my computer for the past year, and I've shared it with my boys. I went almost an entire year with one laptop and two teenage children in my house, and we made that work.
Yeah.
But I'm like sort of like, wow, I can't believe I did that. However, because it was my computer, and I'm very careful about what information I take in, when you open it, it would go to my blog, which is Inspiring Social Change Through Fiction. A very positive idea, right? Well, we get these new PCs from some friends, which is so awesome. The kids have their own computers. It's great. And it got set up with the typical Windows program. And so when you turn on the computer, the MSN webpage pops up. I don't see that. I never see that webpage. And I was sitting there helping my son with his computer, and it pops up. And I looked at it, and it's like 85% of what was coming up on this webpage was all this horrible, terrible stuff going on in the world.
Right.
And I realized I've been protecting myself from the oppressive, fear-mongering media. People really, if they are tuned into mainstream media, they just think everything's scary, terrible, horrible. So, of course, Homeland Security sounds like a great idea. Yes, let's let the police protect us from all these horrible things that are happening. It's so very clearly manipulative.
Right. And it's, you know, it generates tremendous amount of fear.
Yeah.
In everybody, you know, so, and also they just kind of sensationalize the worst of things. You know, I was thinking just about, you know, what's going on in Baltimore. You know, folks there were, you know, protesting the murder of Freddie Gray,
mm-hmm.
you know, the young man that was had his
neck broken.
Right. They were protesting for 6 or 7 days, and there was not any media coverage, mainstream media coverage. But then after 7 or 8 days, then there was a broken window, there was a looting, and all of a sudden now mm-hmm. that's the story, right?
So absolutely.
That's governing, that, you know, that's dominating the narrative. Whereas, you know, what would it have been like if we had 24/7 coverage of 7 days of peaceful protest?
Right.
With the news commentators saying, you know, and Al, how do you understand that they're, you know, what, how do you explain that given the horrendous abuse of, you know, Freddie Gray, that an entire community can be so peaceful?
Right.
And, you know, I mean, that would have been a really interesting conversation to have, but we don't have that, right?
Exactly the same thing happened in Seattle with the Occupy movement
mm-hmm.
and with May Day in particular.
Right.
So
right.
you have the same thing. You can have this massive march with all of these people being peaceful and all these issues being brought up on May Day, right? It's about, you know, workers and all that. And the media will cover the black block kids that broke the Nike window. And
right.
because that happens, they can then legitimately ignore any coverage of the positive messages and the progressive messages and all the people who are being very peaceful. And it's interesting because through Occupy, we did see the emergence of a very effective Black Bloc sort of splintering campaign. You know, basically the peaceful effort crumbled a little bit because this small group came in and gave the media and the police someone to get mad at and to talk about. And it's interesting because I've been to those marches, and I know how much the media could be covering, and therefore I know how much they're ignoring. But the average person who hasn't been to the march, they are going to walk away from media and think it's all Black Bloc people and it's all violence, and they have no idea what else is going on there because they're not on the ground.
Right, right. And again, it's like, you know, folks who have lived under, you know, police brutality for generations, you know, it's none of this is news for them, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, and, you know, I'm thinking back, you know, even to the book, right, which takes place in the 60s and 70s, you know, back then it was, you know, one of the characters, Jackson, her brother, right,
mm-hmm.
is a young African-American kid who's, you know, come back from the war, young man who's come back from the war, and for a while he's dealing drugs and the police don't bother him.
Right.
Then he gets involved in working with the Black Panthers and working with the breakfast programs, right?
Right.
The breakfast programs. And then all of a sudden he becomes targeted.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. And
so
and,
it's been going on, you know, it's been going on, you know, back in when we were talking about like what some of the kids that were living on the streets had to deal with in terms of police abuse. And, you know, again, one of the things that I'm trying to do in the book is call into question like kind of traditional narratives of abuse. Like,
right.
It's not always the boogeyman in the, you know, out in the street that's the bad man. Oftentimes it's the lovely uncle in the home, right?
Oh,
it's not always the, you know, the quote criminals who are the bad guys. It is often those who are supposed to protect and serve who are actually the most dangerous, right?
Oh,
so,
yeah.
You know, that's one of the things that I'm hoping the book does a good job with.
Yeah. You know, all we can do is hope that people will continue to be willing to engage with this complicated world. The planet Earth has one problem, and it is a human problem. And so the only way to solve the problem is through humans.
Wednesday morning at 5 o'clock, as the day begins, silently closing her bedroom door, leaving the note that she hoped would say more. She goes downstairs to the kitchen, clutching her handkerchief. Quietly turning the back door key, stepping outside, she is free.
We gave her most of our lives,
is leaving,
sacrificed most of our lives.
Oh.
We gave her everything money could buy.
She's leaving home after living alone for so many years. Father snores as his wife gets into a dressing gown, picks up the letter that's lying there, standing alone at the top of the stairs. She breaks down and cries to her husband, "Daddy, our baby's gone. Why would she treat us so thoughtlessly? How could she do this to me?
She, we never thought of ourselves.
She's leaving.
Never a thought for ourselves. We struggle hard all our lives to get by.
She's leaving home after living alone. Far away, waiting to keep the appointment she made, meeting a man from the motor trade.
She,
what did we?